No, but the most important issue is power, yeah. is control. Yeah, in other words, absolutely. If I'm going to make a few million dollars less for a few years, okay, but I want to keep my situation, I want to keep the general system running. If a group is a dominant group or a ruling group, we would expect them to have more of what people value in a society. And certainly this upper social class we've been talking about has more wealth, it has more income, it certainly has access to the best education and health care and so on. So on all the measures of who benefits, I think that shows that they are a ruling class. I also think that if we look at the history of any politician in America that rises to the very top, that what we find is that at a certain point in their career, they become very involved with the people that we're talking about here, and that the upper class becomes essential to that politician in terms of the financing of his or her campaigns. At the national level, we have a power elite rooted in large corporations. At the local level, we have a growth machine that's rooted in the attempt to increase the value of land. And what they want is growth, and which intensifies the use of their land.
The American power structure and ruling class come under intense scrutiny in the second in our two-part series with William Domhoff on Who Rules America, right now on Alternative View. Domhoff is America's foremost expert on the American power structure. He has written many books about it, and we're fortunate to continue our two-part series on Who Rules America right now. If you happen to have missed the first of this series, we'll present to you a few short clips of some of the most salient things that Domhoff had to say.
To see these people as a set of interacting and intermarrying set of families who have developed a whole set of social institutions that preserve their way of life. And what I found standing behind these individuals, I believe, are large corporations, large foundations, a series of research institutes, a series of policy discussion groups that make it so that a David Rockefeller is not merely an individual, but is in fact constantly involved, whether it's with a bank or his foundation or policy discussion group like the Council on Foreign Relations. And then one begins to see that there's an ongoing institutional structure. And so that even then, when David Rockefeller retires, you see that the people that now run Chase Manhattan Bank, that now are the directors of the Council on Foreign Relations, continue to be the people that run the country. For instance, under Kennedy, who ran on a platform of getting the country moving again, we've got to get beyond this stodgy Republican establishment, and so on. And yet, when he was elected, the person he put in charge of Treasury was a man named C. Douglas Dillon, from a man worth several hundreds of millions of dollars, who from a major investment house in New York. When we jump to Jimmy Carter, who was our populist, and Hamilton Jordan assured us that we were going to see new faces, in fact, the person that we got as our Secretary of Treasury was a man named W. Michael Blumenthal, who was the head of Bendix Corporation, a trustee of the Council on Foreign Relations, a trustee of the Committee for Economic Development, a trustee of Princeton University, and a member of the Trilateral Commission, and he becomes our Secretary of Treasury. Now, Ronald Reagan comes in, and he's going to get rid of the mess in Washington from a neoconservative perspective, but our Secretary of Treasury is a man named Donald Regan, or was, That was his first Secretary of Treasury, as you know. And Donald Regan was from Merrill Lynch. He was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was a trustee of the Committee for Economic Development. He was a trustee of the Business Roundtable. And what I'm saying, of course, with those examples is that when we look at the cabinet-level appointments of the past 40 years, at the least, but we could go back further. But if we look at the last 40 years, that whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, whether it's a populist or a neoconservative, whatever particular ticket they run on or ideology they run on in order to attract a coalition of voters, when they turn to the question of governing, when they turn to the question of how are they going to implement a set of policies, they do, as your question suggests, they turn to the same group of people. So there are a whole set of mechanisms that legitimate some opinions and make other opinions seem far out or not worth studying.
Once this policy has been set, that the media will follow up on this, and you will not find any discussion on anything on the other side. Mm-hmm. Of this preset agenda by these people you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Or if it is discussed, it's highly criticized, but generally it's just ignored.
Right. Right.
And it all comes down to the point you've made in your previous book, that it is within this range of opinion within the ruling class that we have our democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Anything outside is delegitimized.
Right.
Bill Domhoff is a professor of psychology and sociology at the University of California at Santa Cruz. Here's some more background information on him.
You may know him by the name of G. William Domhoff from a lot of his books. The first book which he came out with, as far as I know, was C. Wright Mills and the Power Elite. C. Wright Mills was the first one to come up with a comprehensive look at power in the United States in 1956. And then Bill's first big book, comprehensive book, was Who Rules America, which has been read by many, many people, and others such as The Bohemian Grove, The Higher Circles, The Powers That Be, and the most recent one, Who Rules America Now? If you want to find out just who does rule America, and it ain't you and I, well, you want to read that book.
When we talk about whether a group is ruling or not, we have to look at three or four indicators of power. One, of course, is we've hit upon when we talked about wealth. If a group is a dominant group or a ruling group, we would expect them to have more of what people value in a society. And certainly this upper social class we've been talking about has more wealth, it has more income. It certainly has access to the best education and health care and so on. So on all the measures of who benefits, I think that shows that they are a ruling class. Because we would all like to be a lot richer. We'd all like to be a lot more secure in our economic circumstance. But I also think that we can show that these people are a ruling class when we look at the kinds of policies that are implemented by the federal government. And these policies range from subsidies for specific corporations and industries, tax breaks, a little shaving on regulations, mm-hmm. and so on up to more general policies. Policies that I think basically benefit large corporations as a group. And that means kinds of foreign policies that maximize the possibility of investment overseas. Policies at the domestic level that maximize the possibility of a tranquil and happy and docile workforce, numerous kinds of policy. I also think that if we look at the history of any politician in America that rises to the very top, that what we find is that at a certain point in their career, they become very involved with the people that we're talking about here, and that the upper class becomes essential to that politician in terms of the financing of his or her campaigns. And that means things like financing their travel, giving them money in advance so they can schedule all their television time, giving them the kind of money that allows them to hire experts. And basically then it gives any politician that gets involved with these people a leg up in any particular political race. And these politicians are not going to have a set of policy stances that are going to be inimical to the ruling group.
Jimmy Carter is a perfect example.
Jimmy Carter is a fine example, and we could say that he's a nice example in terms of the fact that it was not really until he got to the state level that he got involved with the well-to-do of Atlanta, and then some well-to-do people in Atlanta thought that he might be potentially a national level politician and got him involved with the Trilateral Commission, where he met a lot of people who in turn national elites that gave him a lot of money. But if we look at Nixon, Nixon's another kind of interesting example in that well-to-do Republicans in the Los Angeles area were looking for a candidate to challenge a liberal in Congress. And they interviewed, literally put out the word that they wanted to interview candidates. And they decided on Nixon, and they bankrolled Nixon from that point forward. But let's take Hubert Humphrey. Humphrey was a liberal person who, I think in early parts of his career, was not heavily involved with the people I'm talking about. But once he wanted to go beyond the state level, it's real clear in terms of his campaign finance that that he was involved with a relative handful of people that in 1968, for instance, lent him, 20, 25 people lent him a couple million dollars for his campaign. So, as I say, you can look at the liberals, or you can look at Ronald Reagan, you can look at Nixon, you can look at Carter, and as they, when they decide they want to go beyond a local or state level milieu, they get involved with the people we're talking about.
They have to, otherwise they can't, they don't have the financial
backing. They just don't have the financial backing. It's like thinking of politics as this real high stakes poker game that you have to have a few million dollars to be in it. And you see, this is where we get back to this question about, is there a power structure? Americans are used to thinking, well, if there's a power structure, we wouldn't even be allowed to be in politics. But in America, you're allowed to run for president. You can run for anything you want. There's just one thing. You better have several million dollars or access to people that have several million dollars. So you see, we can say on the one hand, well, it's very fair. Anybody can run. But, in fact, not anybody can when you get down to the specifics of the matter. So we have a formally open and liberal system, but in practice, the way things work out is that the rich get richer, and they are able to continue a set of policies that maximize their advantages. It is also the case, we can see it, we can all name some, that there are elected officials in the United States who are not part of the power elite, and they very often do oppose their positions. So I have no doubt there are pro-labor, there are pro-environmental, there are very liberal elected officials at various levels in our society, and that does create then real conflict. So that my point would be, it's not that there aren't such people there. My point is, they usually lose, just as you say. In effect, if we look at the FCC, or if we look at the FTC, if we look at various kinds of attempts to create, for instance, a consumer protection agency with some teeth,
OSHA, that we
eventually lose. They grind us down, and they grind us down because they have this institutional base behind them. They have more staying power, and furthermore, eventually, with these liberal elected officials, they constantly run at these people. One of the things that's so interesting to me is to watch the way in which a liberal politician will come to Congress, and if he or she starts to really vote in a way that's constantly annoying to the business community, they will, quote, target that person. They will constantly send a lot of money to candidates that are running against this person in the district. So keeping the person on the defensive, letting them know that one false step and they're going to eliminate them. So, you see, my view is not of a power structure that's sort of sitting there and it's all signed, sealed, and delivered and never challenged. In America, the power structure is constantly challenged, but it basically constantly wins, except on, you know, occasionally it doesn't. But so there is real conflict in America, and I think your point really brings that out well, and I think that it's important not to deny that. But it's important to see who wins.
That's the key to this, is that we do have a pluralistic society, but we do not have a pluralistic economic and political structure.
I think that's excellent. I think that we have the paradox over the last 20 years that a lot of the social movements that have happened, a lot of the events, have made in some ways this a very open society at the individual, personal kind of level, mm-hmm. and yet I continue to believe we have the same corporate power structure. And I don't think it's necessarily a contradiction in terms that my access to certain kind of information, my right to do things as an individual, which is a very important part of liberalism, that could be increased in the society. And it has been for minorities, for women, for gays, for handicapped. Those kinds of liberal individual freedoms could actually be in some way increased, and we could still be relatively powerless.
So far you've talked about a cohesion
right.
within the ruling class, but aren't there significant conflicts mm-hmm. at times? The Vietnam War, for instance, there were two opposing views where people, the establishment, mm-hmm. took pro and anti-war positions. I think in Reagan's income tax reform, obviously there's no cohesion or they can't come to mm-hmm. agreement. How do you explain conflicts within the ruling class? What are the main divisions, mm-hmm. if any?
Okay.
And what forms do they take?
Okay. Once we have set this general kind of framework mm-hmm. that we've been talking about, in which we in effect know that these corporate people feel a lot of commonness, from there we can go on to say that they do argue about various kinds of things. And that I do think that we see some relatively long-lasting kinds of differences of opinions over specific kinds of issues. And you mentioned the division of opinion that developed over the Vietnam War, which I think was very real and very important. At the same time, from my point of view, the debate over what to do went on in precisely the organizations we're talking about. That is, put more specifically, in the early 60s, I think there was complete consensus in the power elite that it was necessary to go into Vietnam. As the war went more and more badly, real significant differences of opinion developed in the late 60s, particularly in the face of the Tet Offensive. And this manifested itself then in very vehement arguments at a place like the Council on Foreign Relations. And experts came there, for instance, one person, Samuel Huntington from Harvard, and he would say to the discussion groups things like this. He said, look, things have changed. We've got to look at this differently. First of all, there's a Sino-Soviet split. Second, there's no big communist party now in Indonesia. That's been wiped out, and that makes less of a threat in Southeast Asia in general. Thirdly, there hasn't been the spread of the Cuban Revolution in Latin America. And then fourthly, we're now facing a major ghetto uprising in this country. Real unsettling things are happening.
And the peace movement,
too. And the peace movement is the next thing. Yeah. Faced with this, and given what it's going to cost us to win in Vietnam, we should get out of that war gradually. Now, what's interesting is that a set of people that were known around Washington as the wise men, these were people that Johnson brought in once a month. The wise men switched their views on the war. Well, there were about a dozen of them. Ten of them, at least, were in this Council on Foreign Relations. Three investment bankers, three corporate lawyers, a couple retired military. All had been in and out of government, in and out of corporations. And they said that they heard all the government officials talk about what was needed after Tet. And they went to Johnson and they said to him, don't send more troops to Vietnam. According to all accounts, he was kind of stunned by this. And 1 week later, he went on the TV, and he announced he would not run for president again. And that was kind of a crucial kind of turning point. Definitely a division of opinion developed on how to deal with this situation. They changed their mind. Now, there are also longer-lasting kinds of divisions of opinion between people that, in terms of the American political spectrum, that we would call moderate kinds of conservatives. They are either conservative Democrats or moderate Republicans. Their opinions differ from those of very conservative people, sometimes called ultra-conservative. The moderate conservatives come, I believe, from the biggest and most international corporations in America, by and large. These corporations are in favor of more and more free trade. They are willing to see some kinds of social welfare policies used. They believe that there is some validity to a Keynesian economics. The ultra-conservative people tend to come from smaller corporations and privately held corporations, that is where the family owns it and the stock is not publicly traded. And they tend to be in very competitive kinds of national markets, that they sell their products in some region of America and aren't trying to get overseas or don't have the money to get overseas. Those people have been historically very isolationist on foreign policy. They have been opposed to the slightest welfare state developments, including Social Security. And these people tend to believe that a deficit in spending is the work of the devil.
Very anti-labor, too, against any concessions to labor, whereas the more moderates are willing to bring them in, or at least the conservative labor.
Some of them. I think there, I want to say that I think I was a little wrong in some things that I wrote in the early 70s, particularly in 1970. I had the understanding from my earlier work that that the people I've just described as moderates were moderates towards unions. They're moderate towards labor in the sense of willing to improve welfare benefits, willing to change things that workers complain about within the factory. But they do not like unions either. In other words, no part of this power structure likes unions. And the reason we've had unions, I'm convinced, is because of the power of workers in the industries that have unions. One of the things that I think is very important to understand about the Reagan administration is that I believe that the kinds of people I've characterized as moderate conservatives are basically the people running that administration, people like George Shultz, like Donald Regan, like Caspar Weinberger, like Malcolm Baldrige at Commerce. They are basically what I call moderate conservatives. The people in the second and third level positions in the Reagan government are ultra-conservatives. But then you say, well, look at the labor policies. The labor policies are very conservative because unions are less powerful now. The moderates like the idea of stomping on these unions, but they couldn't do it in the past. See, you couldn't stomp on unions in the Nixon administration, not because Nixon was friendly to unions, but because in the face of the unrest in America, his whole appeal was to hard hats. These are the true Americans. He wasn't going to attack unions when he was trying to build them as a base against these awful students who were demonstrating. But now we have a different situation that Reagan faces. We have a time of peace and quiescence within our country. Maybe there are people grumbling. There are certainly people becoming poor, and I think that's a tragedy. But there's nobody disrupting America. And furthermore, there's no war going on out there somewhere. And furthermore, there is the internationalization of production that has led to an enormous number of jobs going overseas, which has decimated the steel union, the auto union, and some of the other. In that context, you can go get the union. And that's why I think Reagan is doing it. Not because he's more conservative than these previous administrations, but because the situation has changed in such a way it's now possible to go after the union.
Would you say also it's because that there is no big union uprising or like there were back in the early 1900s and the 30s? Mm-hmm. The labor struggles are essentially over as far as the labor hierarchy is concerned. Yeah. So they've even brought them into some of these elite organizations that you've been talking about.
That's absolutely
the Trilateral Commission.
Right. It's absolutely true that the leadership of the AFL-CIO is invited to sit on the board of a Rockefeller Foundation, is invited to be in these discussion groups like Trilateral Commission or Council on Foreign Relations. I think that some of that is definitely part of the picture. But it's more like once there are unions and we've got to live with them, then we'll talk to these guys. But we're certainly not really accepting them. And if the time comes that we can undercut them further, we sure will. And
that shows the flexibility of the ruling class, that if there is ferment from below, if there is a challenge to the system, they will retrench and give a bit so they can maintain their control. But just as soon as the opposition is weak, then they'll push it back. And
that's my view about the moderate conservatives. That is, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And when there was a real disruption in American society, starting with the civil rights movement, then the anti-war movement, ghetto uprising, they were willing. And I mean,
well,
by
they were forced to.
Yeah, they were forced to. Then they were willing to have a family assistance plan, for instance. They were willing to see better health care, national health care. These were actually programs advocated by this organization called the Committee for Economic Development. But when the unrest went away, the policy position of the Committee for Economic Development changed in this much more conservative kind of way. I think it's an important kind of flexibility that means that the possibility of reform keeps the system stable. You see, what's implied by your comment, which I agree with, or I claim is implied, is that for these people...
Well, I got it from your book anyway.
No, no, but the most important issue is power, yeah, is control. In other words,
absolutely,
if I'm going to make a few million dollars less for a few years, okay, but I want to keep my situation, I want to keep the general system running. You see, in the face of unrest, there is another possibility. You can put all the people in jail. You can repress them. You can do very negative kinds of things. And there are sometimes people that advocate those kinds of solutions.
And there are laws in the books which would permit this if the government decides.
But it doesn't work very well. I mean, often it evokes more unrest, more rebellion.
It has that possibility. But even in the middle 1930s, and here I'm jumping to a time of extreme labor unrest, and perhaps the most militant time that there were, that there was only a short kind of window of opportunity, to use the common parlance, of that when sit-down strikes were legitimate in the minds of most Americans. Within a year or so of those sit-down strikes, the public opinion was opposed to them. Even in the 1930s, I think that a majority of American people were still rural, small-town workers, the white-collar workers. They were not crazy about the union movement. I think that very conservative of solutions could have been enacted against the union movement if there had been a different administration, if there had been a Republican administration, if there had not been Democrat administrations in Michigan and Pennsylvania. I think we would have had continued conflict in those labor struggles. And I say that in the context of the fact that after U.S. Steel was organized, after General Motors was organized, then they, in the case of the Steelworkers Union, they went into Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio to try to organize Little Steel. And they did not succeed. There were many people killed and jailed in Ohio. Every labor organizer that they sent into Ohio was put in a jail at one time or another. And it was not until World War II, when Roosevelt said, we've got to stop this labor strife to fight this war, that those steel companies were organized. And one of them never.
Well, it seems to follow logically from your analysis of the power structure that the only way that progressive political change and reform can come in the United States is through political struggle from below, in which the power structure is forced to make certain concessions and certain reforms to stop unrest from growing into outright rebellion or revolution. Right. That they themselves are not so generous or pro-labor. That if you don't have a strong union movement, strong social movements, and agitation, actual struggle for change, the power structure is going to rule on unopposed and do more or less what's in their interest, which is often against everyone else's.
No, they're going to continue to go through their routines. From the way we as sociologists talk about that point is in terms of the question of disrupting people's routines. That is, basically, a society is organized in a set of institutions and roles in such a way that people can go about their everyday business. What that means in terms of people watching this program, they can get up in the morning and they can go to school, they can look forward to graduating, they can say, okay, I'm able to get a job, I'll be able to have a family, I'll be able to have my vacations, my weekends. Living in that ordinary life is very compelling. It draws people into those routines. For anything to happen to lead to change, there has to be in some way a disruption of those routines. And I'm using that very generally because if we look at what happened that changed America in the 30s, it was a massive disruption of a non-union America by this incredible depression. There was, unions were a very small matter in the 1920s. But when this economic system would no longer work and people were thrown out of their routines, they started to vote and then when they voted Democrat, they started to organize unions. But it was that disruption and sit-ins, you know, we get very concrete, one of the key dramatic elements in the early 1937, right at the start of 1937, was a sit-in in a General Motors factory in Flint, Michigan, which meant the capitalists could not go through their routines. They could not go in and get these cars made. And the sit-in movement then flashed across the country in all kinds of other factories and really gave this tremendous impetus to the union. But now let's look at the 60s. The 60s led to a lot of changes, not because of labor disruption, not because of economic failure, but first of all, because of the fact that there had been created a small black middle class in the South that wanted to insist that the country live up to its liberal values. And how did they do it? They did it at the key point by disrupting people's routines. They sat down in lunch counters and said, "We will not move. We shall not be moved." And that sit-in movement once again spread to buses, to all kinds of facilities where people sat in, and they disrupted the lives of these people. They could not, in Birmingham, for instance, they boycott the downtown. They march through the downtown. Now, no longer can you just go downtown and shop. Can you go to your office? You got to worry something going to happen. The anti-war movement did the same thing. The anti-war movement disrupted the routines of administrators, of faculty, indeed of the likes of Secretary of Defense McNamara. He could not go to Harvard and collect his honorary degree because there were people out in the streets protesting, jostling his car, hissing and booing, and so on. That is what makes things happen. Now, I'm not advocating by this, say, for instance, violence. I'm describing, and I happen to believe personally that the best kinds of disruptions are nonviolent direct action. But I'm saying, but stepping back from, you know, my advocacy there, again, into the role of describer or analyst, is what I'm saying is that when we do see change, what we see is in some way people's routines have been disrupted. And what will cause that is economic dislocation, wars. Sometimes it'll be some kind of an accident that will disrupt people's routines, a major oil spill, a major radiation accident.
Or a nuclear accident, right? Like we're seeing now in the Soviet Union, may force people.
Right. It forces people out of their routines. And also in the face of these accidents, what happens that's very interesting in terms of our normal everyday beliefs is that an accident makes it very hard to manage the news. Mm-hmm. You know, tremendous amount of what comes across the media is when a spokesperson for the State Department or the president or whatever stands up at this carefully staged press conference and tells us what's happening or is going to happen. The corporation releases a statement saying we're now going to build this kind of car or whatever. In the face of an accident, they can't sort of get their viewpoint, they can't get their line together, and often will unravel for them, and we get a very revealing picture then of a power structure in the face of a break in routine. And of course Watergate was a nice example of that. And finally we end up, of all things, with the tapes of Richard Nixon's conversations in the White House. Now that was over an accident, when a man that wasn't supposed to be arrested was arrested. You lie about it, you don't have your story real straight, and that leads to another thing, and it just kept unraveling in this wonderful kind of, in that case it was a disruption in their levels. Right. And it spread in a way that then gave us this incredible information about how the power structure operated. Another example of the way in which disruption is important, but also we learned much about the power structure, involves Daniel Ellsberg, who was a policy analyst for the Defense Department and had worked for a think tank called the RAND Corporation, had often been an advisor to major policymakers at these discussion groups. Ellsberg was from a union family, but had gone on to go to Harvard and become this big expert. But in the face of the anti-war movement, it rekindled in him, he reported, his feelings of his background. And he decided that the war was so wrong that he was going to reveal the origins of this war by putting the Pentagon Papers out in the general public. And so, in a word, we learned this amazing detail of the fact that of how the whole war policy was made, of the fact that they were saying one thing and doing another. In other words, they knew the problems they were going to have winning that war at the very time they were saying it was going to be a lead pipe cinch. So, but Ellsberg just wasn't somebody that suddenly decided to give these papers out. It was only the disruption in the society that gradually got to him in terms of kind of stripping away the veneer that he had learned that made him then re-identify with people that were struggling in the society. So accidents, scandals, break routines, and major social disruptions like a civil rights movement or a ghetto uprising, which involves a massive movement of black people from south to north. That was one of the largest migrations of a people in history in such a short time. And that unsettles a social system. Here are people that were basically rural people and farm people, all of a sudden in inner cities, in another atmosphere, namely in the north. And that was a disruption of those cities, partly, mostly because, of course, the white people didn't like it, and then there was all the white flight. At any rate, that's what then creates the opportunities for people to battle with these power structures. And in that context, the moderate conservatives are willing to bend. And in that sense, we get reforms in our system.
Which may be lost later.
Which very definitely can be lost later, and that's the kind of the story of what's happened with the Reagan years. That is, the disruption is gone, patriotism is back, there's no wars. In that context, the conservatives then all of a sudden talk about how, well, these were just liberal experiments. These were just a bunch of intellectuals trying out ideas. In other words, they totally ignore the fact that that these things were all done in the face of real pressure. And they are, of course, trying to undercut all those programs.
Let's turn now to the local level. What is the difference between the power structure on the local and the national level, and the differences between the possibilities for individual participation and impact locally and nationally?
Okay. I think that local power structures are rooted not in large corporations that produce a product, which is where the national power structure is rooted, but rather local power structures are rooted in real estate, in land, in development. At the local level, we have what we like to call a growth machine. At the national level, we have a power elite rooted in large corporation. At the local level, we have a growth machine that's rooted in the attempt to increase the value of land. And what they want is growth, and which intensifies the use of their land. Now, that means then that we have to look at a complex of landowners, developers, real estate salespeople, and so on, and mortgage banks, savings and loans tied around development. That's what happens at the local level. The key issues to a local power structure are the water board, the parking and transportation board, the planning board, the zoning board. That's the real politics for local power structure. The other issues are for them symbolic, some of the things that concern other citizens. But the local power structure is concerned with growth. Now, the local power structure does relate to the national power structure in a very important way. And that is that what a local power structure tries to do is to attract national capital. That is, they try to prepare the land, their area, so it will be attractive to the new building, the new high-rise building that General Motors wants to put up somewhere. So we try to, as a local city, they try to say, look, we have the cheapest land that you could want, we have a very nice and docile labor force, we have low taxes. So all these local growth machines compete with each other to try to get the General Motors factory, the Exxon office building, or more generally, the new campus of the University of Texas. They try to get the new Defense Department installation. Because if you bring one of those major capital kinds of structures into your city, it will mean new jobs for people, it will mean then more money, more spending for the local retailers, and you will then, your land will be valuable because now the local retailer is making more money, so you can charge him more rent on the building that you've rented him. So I think that's really important to understand that the land-based nature of local power structures versus this more capital-based nature, totally capital-based nature of the national power structure. I've just then suggested that there's a lot of commonality between them, that they have reasons to work together. But you also must understand that there's tensions between them, because if, say, the labor force becomes very radical in a given city, General Motors might say, okay, we're leaving. We're going overseas, or we're going to Tennessee. And that, at that point, they can leave behind a broken local growth machine. So the local growth machine often finds itself angry with national-level capital when it leaves. So there's tension between them as well as cooperation. Now, it's also important to understand that at the local level, the primary tension is created between the growth machine as it attempts to expand and the rest of the people who are trying to live their lives in their neighborhoods. At the national level, we have a lot of conflict between the owners of corporations and other people as workers. As workers, we want more wages, which, of course, from the capitalist point of view, is inflationary. We want various kinds of benefits, which from their point of view might make us lazy and not work as hard, and so on. So we have a capital-labor tension in national politics that underlies a lot of the fights over welfare and inflation and so on. But at the local level, the fight is between a growth machine and the rest of us who, as neighbors, as living in a neighborhood, the growth machine's tendency is to move out and move into neighborhoods, either to put in office buildings or to put in apartment buildings. That is, say you're living in this nice, wonderful neighborhood, you've bought this house, all the people have these, you know, single family dwelling, and in comes the growth machine because there's more people now, and they can make more money if they put a big apartment building in the middle of your little area, and you don't like that. The constant fight is between then the growth machine and neighborhoods, and that really animates city politics. Now, this conflict can be very liberal, or it can be very reactionary. That is, that sometimes neighborhoods are protecting themselves from toxic waste, from tremendous overcrowding, and a liberal person can certainly understand that and identify with that kind of, with the neighbors in that conflict. But other times, the conflict is such that it's very reactionary because the neighbors are trying to keep out minority people. Or they are, in essence, saying, we don't want more dense zoning because we like having our two-acre lot. But by having a two-acre lot, they're making housing prices more expensive for everybody in the city. So, in other words, you can't then find enough land to build houses for people of more average income. So what I'm then saying is that you have to look at this constant conflict between the growth machine and neighborhoods, but at the same time, you don't necessarily say one side's going to be more, or that the neighborhoods are going to be progressive. Now, what then happens in local politics is that some neighborhood issue will come up. That is, in some way, the growth machine will encroach upon a neighborhood. They're going to put a bigger freeway in. They're going to put a high-rise in. They're going to put a factory that belches smoke into the neighborhood in. One of those, they're going to put a noisy installation in. The neighborhood will be incredibly galvanized. It will fight. But once the fight is over in their neighborhood, they tend to lapse back into their ordinary routines. And of course, in terms of something I said earlier, you can now see my generalization about disruption. Mm-hmm. People go into action when their routines are disrupted. And if I live in this nice, idyllic neighborhood, and now there's going to be this smelly smokestack plant, or this noisy office building, or a big freeway right near my house, you've disrupted what I see as my routine existence, you see. Or you've now overcrowded this school. Or for some people, you put minority kids in this school by building this new neighborhood. You've disrupted what I saw as my way of life, and I become an activist at the neighborhood level. But once my neighborhood is taken care of, I tend to lapse back into quietude once again. So in a city, at different times, we'll see different neighborhoods in action.
Meanwhile, the structures and organizations, institutions of the local power structure remain intact and remain in basic control.
Right. And they're usually, of course, rooted in the Chamber of Commerce, but there's usually some watchdog tax organization. There's also some real estate association. There's also at the national level, incidentally, an organization called the Urban Land Institute that does the think tanking for these local growth machines. These local growth machines have committees of the Chamber of Commerce that parallel the government committees. That is, for instance, for the Planning Commission, there's also a committee of the Chamber of Commerce that looks at planning. So they have a whole parallel structure to go alongside the government. And usually what happens then, incidentally, is that a person is legitimated as a city leader by being a president of the chamber, by being the head of its planning committee, and then that person then gets appointed to the Planning Commission. Then after he or she has been on the Planning Commission for a while, which then legitimates them as a city servant, they then run for city government. In one city in Northern California, in a larger study that was done by political scientists of 10 or 15 Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area city, they had the most wonderful process. I mean, these people had such a lock on the whole thing, it was outrageous. And that the way it worked was, you'd appoint the person to the Planning Commission. Midway, and then, you had your people on the city council. Midway through the person on the city council's second term, it was a two-term limit in that city. Midway through the person's second term, they would resign. And the person from the Planning Commission would be appointed by the rest of the city council to the city council. That person would then 2 years later run as an incumbent for the next term, and then, of course, do his resignation after he won his second election 2 years. So you had a process then that everybody that was running was always an incumbent by means of appointment. But you can see the process from you're a local growth machine member, you get involved in a chamber committee, you get appointed to the Planning Commission, then you run for city council. That's sort of the ideal career from the local power structure.
Santa Cruz, though, where you live, have a progressive city council. How were people able to counter this sort of machine or power structure politics?
They seem to have been able to maintain it a while.
Right. They have been, but the important thing to understand is that where there have been successful challenges to the growth machine, there has been very great environmental concern coupled with, usually, student politics. That is, when the University of California was brought to Santa Cruz by the growth machine as the perfect complement to the tourism industry, Santa Cruz is on the wonderful, beautiful beach, and its main thing for the growth machine is tourism, which means it doesn't want any dirty industry spoiling it. But the university was a clean industry, high-level, springing in students. You get that state budget. It was a great coup for that local growth machine to get UC Santa Cruz. Okay. And also, furthermore, the university runs in the winter, and tourism tends to run in the summer. It was perfect. But the university was put inside the city limits for water hookups and other minor kind of reasons. But the university is a giant Trojan horse inside the growth machine, because once this 18-year-old vote was put in, the growth machine has not won a single battle in Santa Cruz. They wanted to expand northward on the coast with a big freeway, and they would have taken in huge ranch lands that would have become 40, 50,000 people. It's all going to be park. They wanted to expand their amusement area on a beautiful piece of land. It was stopped by the environmentalists in the city, plus the student vote. So I think that the answer in Santa Barbara, in Santa Cruz, in Davis, California, with progressive governments, is student vote. But right over the hill from where I live is Palo Alto, California. And in that particular city, the growth machine has also been stopped in good measure. But there you have to understand that the people that it was a suburban town, and the people who live in that town are well-to-do people, and it's their neighborhood. And they fought off the growth machine in that town by getting experts to do a study which showed that the developable land, which was on these foothills, that it was actually cheaper for the city to buy that land and put it in preserve than to pay for all of the infrastructure that would be needed to develop that land. You see, the standard line of the growth machine is that it's very good to have development because it will create more jobs and bring in more taxes. When you do a cost-benefit analysis, it often is the case, but not necessarily always, that it costs more to bring in this new growth to ordinary citizens than they really do get out of it. So in some places, the growth machine has been stopped. There's also a wonderful a kind of, if I may use the word, a dialectic that goes on between the growth machine and a neighborhood, because the growth machine will create a new community, and they'll build all these houses, and the people will be very happy, and everything's lovely. But as you get more and more people in the city, at a certain point, the very city you've created as a developer rises up and says, you are going to spoil what you originally promised if you bring more people. And then all of a sudden there's a vote against the developers, and they are stopped. So that kind of conflict happened. Progressive governments. Now, I want to say one other thing related to this growth machine business that's outside of a city level. It shows how different the disruptions can be. Santa Monica, California also has a very progressive government. What happened there was, it was a city of little single dwellings. Very nice little city on the coast. Had some well-to-do, but a lot of it was middle class. A new freeway was developed in the late 60s, I believe it was, called the Santa Monica Freeway. And what that freeway did was make it possible for Santa Monica now to be a bedroom community for lots more of L.A., which was a very attractive possibility because of smog. That meant that the land in L.A., in Santa Monica, was now tremendously more valuable if you put high-rises on it. So Santa Monica was dramatically transformed into this community of these huge apartments. Now, once you have these people in these apartments, then, of course, you want to charge them maximum rent. And in the context of the 70s, their rents were going up like crazy. And some of these people were retired people, and they were middle-level people. What happened was that some progressive people moved to that city, and they said the sensible issue to organize this city around is rent control. And they went out and ran a rent control initiative. Now, the first time they lost, but then something called Proposition 13 happened in California that controlled property taxes. Part of winning that, part of the growth machines in California winning that Proposition 13 was to promise their renters that they wouldn't raise their rents, because now property taxes would be lower. But in fact, rents went up the following year in Santa Monica, and the progressive politicians went back at another growth rent control initiative, and this time they won overwhelmingly, plus their candidates won for city council. But the politics of Santa Monica have to be understood in terms of a very dramatically, rapidly changing a situation for the growth machine, in which it had realized fantastic values thanks to this freeway, put up all of these apartment buildings, but once they started to really raise the rents on these people, the people rebelled through rent control. So rent control became the device through which the growth machine was controlled.
Disruption, struggle, etc. And then we see the power structure moving in again with a media blitz in later campaigns, putting a lot of money in getting some of these progressives out.
Some of them.
It's a constant sort of struggle.
Right. And in the case of Santa Monica, where I think the progressive politicians were very far-sighted, very clever about this, and had the kind of theory we're talking about that allowed them to anticipate, they said, where are these growth machine people going to strike back at us? They said they're going to strike back on us talking about crime, about more police and so on. So the next program that the progressives developed was one around a progressive way of dealing with the question of crime and prevention of crime and so on. And in essence, what they did was to take away every issue that the growth machine tried to use to beat them. At a certain point, what happened in Santa Monica that again shows this flexibility is that the developers would come to them and say, okay, we want to develop certain things. What do you want? And they'd say, well, we'll let you build a building here if you put a park over here, if you put childcare over here, and if you put some low-income housing over here, we'll let you develop it. But the big developers would cost it out, and they'd say, okay. The smaller developers would say, it's blackmail. It's blackmail. They were angry. But you know what? Today, I just read this in the last month or two in New York Times, 60-70% of American cities are now doing that very kinds of, quote, blackmail with developers. They're saying, you're going to develop? Okay, you're going to pay for the school. You're going to pay for the new roads. You're going to put a park over here. You're going to put some low-income housing over here.
I wonder if Austin's doing this yet.
No, we aren't that progressive.
Maybe we have a lesson to learn from
this. Yeah, that's the way. I mean, the developers will accommodate to that. See, here's the dynamic of America. The power, because of our history and our ideology, the way the economic system worked, tremendous amount of power is lodged then in these private economic institutions, developers, landed interests at the local level, capital, big corporations at the national level. The only thing that other people can do is to gain some measure of political power that forces these economic powers to, in some way, accommodate. When you have in Santa Cruz, you see where progressive and liberal people have political power. What they use that for is to then make trades with these business people to bring amenities to the cities. Just recently, the two sides cut a deal in which the downtown business community and the tourism industry agreed to accept with no fight an amusement tax. But that amusement tax is going to be used to fund social services in Santa Cruz that would probably be lost if these Reagan cutbacks go through, the ones that are currently being debated in Congress. And certainly were eliminated. Reagan proposed getting rid of all these support services. So we're able to get these social kinds of services. And as I say, you can allow them to build certain kinds of things if they'll do it in an environmentally sound way, and if they'll also build other kinds of things. And so you have this irony of where we're getting sort of public amenities, but not through taxation, which our ideology in America generally is such that it's very hard then to tax anybody, including these people, and to go after taxing them directly. They can often then use that against you. But if you say, we'll let you develop this if you give us the following amenities, it works.
Well, Bill, you've got a lecture coming up here in a few minutes at the University of Texas. We want to thank you for it.
Well, it's my pleasure. I've enjoyed it greatly. It's been a lot of fun.
And it seems to me that the basic to a lot of what you were saying all the way through is that we do have an American power structure, but the people have to struggle and organize and demand and put pressure on it, because otherwise it's liable to do a job on it.
Americans are all liberals in a classic sense, whether they think of themselves as Republicans or Democrats. And we have to constantly build on that liberal tradition, use that liberal tradition, and use it against the power structure. It's part of our culture. There's a history of activism at various levels of our country. There's America's basically, if I put it this way in closing, America's a conservative country with a liberal ideology in which, at various times, we get these chances. And what you have to do is make hay when those chances come, like in the 30s or like in the 60s. And I think it'll come around again. And then the trick is to be there basically demanding as much democracy, as much civil liberty as you possibly can, all of which are perfectly legitimate things to ask for in the United States of America.
And that's Alternative Views for this time. Glad you could join us again. We'd like to thank our camera person, Eric Eubank, our audio man, Kevin L. West, and, of course, Austin Community Television, ACTV. Bye.